The KM Football Podcast. Exclusive interviews with the biggest names in Kent football.
Welcome to this week's KM Football Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Panting, and as always, I'm joined in the studio by Steve Turvett of the KM Sports Desk. Our guest this week started his career with the Crazy Gang at Wimbledon and played in the Football League for Rushden and Diamonds. Since then, he has made his name in non-league circles, where success seems to follow him around. Playoff victories at both Hastings and Tunbridge was trumped by a double promotion with Maidstone. He left the Gallagher Line a year ago now and linked up with Andy Hessenthaler's Dover, where he's also taken his first steps on the coaching ladder. We know we're in safe hands for the next hour or so as we welcome Lee Walgan to the podcast. Lee, good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me in.
We'll start with Dover. Bright start to the season, but of course, often the way when our guests come into the studio, we can't prejudge what's gone on the Saturday. 2-1 defeat home to Torquay at the weekend. Your thoughts on that one, first of all?
Yeah, it was disappointing. We've obviously started the season really well. And our home form's been a little bit up and down. We've obviously gone into the game Saturday and sort of the result came out of nowhere, really. We started the game, we got to half time, we didn't really get going, and then we come unstuck. Bobby Joe got injured, he came off the pitch, and we were 10 men for a few minutes, and in that time they scored two goals, one from a corner and won a free header in the box, and you're 2-0 down. And no matter how you're playing in this division, you know, it's a very, very big ask to come back from 2-0 down.
As I said before, it's been a positive start, even three really good wins on the board. You know, everyone quite optimistic that it's going to go quite well this season?
Yeah, very. I think in-house we're extremely optimistic. We've recruited well over the summer. We've got a very, very good squad. It's the competition for places is immense. You know, you've got to make sure you're on your game every week, otherwise there's someone waiting in the wings. So, in-house, we're confident that we can do well this season. It's an unforgiving league, though. And as we found out, at the weekend, we've lost to, although Torquay are a big club, they come up last season. And if you take your half the ball for a minute, you come unstuck. So we need to make sure that we're on it every week. And hopefully come May, we can be up and in amongst it.
It's a crazy schedule in the National League, isn't it? I mean, you play about a third of your games by early October. Is this something that you've grown accustomed to almost now because you've been in that level for a few years?
Yeah, I think you do, yeah. Yeah, you know, you hear a lot of sort of top-end professional players saying about the Championship being a tough league, and, you know, I'd like to see them try their luck in the National League. It's like I said, it's very unforgiving. But, yeah, it's tough. It's a little bit crazy, if I'm honest. I don't know why you'd need to play. I think we play from the 3rd of August to 3rd of September. I think it's 9 or 10 games, which is just crazy. But, you've got to manage your squad well, which the gaffer does, and, you know, make sure that we're prepared and we're recovering well, and then we're getting ready to go into each game, because it's, like I said, it's two games a week. But again, you need to make sure your pre-season's good, because, like you said, by the time October comes, you play the third of your games and you're pretty much your season's outlined for you, so you need to make sure that you're up and in and around it.
And there's no gimmies in that league, are there?
There's no gimmies at all. Yeah, you sort of, I remember getting the fixtures out and I sat at home and I looked at it, and you look down the fixtures and you're looking for a game where you think, you know, that's a definite, or that, and there just isn't any. And you go to some tough away games, and you've got to make sure that, like I said, every week is tough, so you've got to be on it.
Just on the quiet, you've established yourself as Dover's number one, so let's talk a bit about that.
I come into the club last October, and then it was in a player coach capacity, which I was looking to do anyway towards the end of my Maidstone contract. Andy Hessenthaler, the manager, Nicky Southall, and Darren, who I'd all worked with before, I'd made aware that I was able to go into the club. I'd come in. I had a good 3 months working with Mitch Walker, and at the time, Mitch's form was here and there, and the manager threw me in, and you know I played the last 10 games of the season. I felt I benefited from the break of leaving Maidstone, and then obviously playing games for Dover. And here we've come this season. I've had a very, very good pre-season, along with Yusuf Mersin, but the gaffer gave me the nod, and I've started the season, you know, fairly well. So it's, you know, as I've said before, I'm an older, more experienced goalkeeper now, so I think I just enjoy every minute of it rather than any thinking any further ahead. So every game to me is a plus, and you know, I just go from there, really.
Is it almost a pleasant surprise to find yourself as number one in August again?
It was a surprise, because again, I didn't come to the club in that capacity. That was not what the outline was. But I think I surprised quite a few, especially myself, with how well and how much I probably needed the break mentally after, you know, I played a lot of football at Maidstone. I played pretty much consecutively for 5.5 years. So I think that my mindset was maybe needed a break, my body maybe needed a break. I come into the team and then again I sort of finished the season and I got a bit of hunger back and I just thought, you know, I'd like to be involved next year and, you know, whatever way I can, and got the gloves on pre-season. Everything was going well and, you know, I got that taste for wanting to play again.
Is it just as simple as a change of scenery, some different voices around you and cracking on with a new club?
Yeah, I think so. I think, again, when you go into the same training ground, every week for 5 years, 6 years, mentally you might become a bit distorted, a bit tired, and even a change of scenery, a change of a manager's opinion on how he wants you to play. I think, you know, the way the gaffer wants to play, it suits the way I play as a goalkeeper, as that sort of sweeper element that I've got. And it just all fits together at the moment. So, you know, hopefully it continues for as long as possible because I'm enjoying every minute of it.
We probably don't think that much about, when you talk about the way that a team plays, how that impacts the goalkeeper and a goalkeeper having their own style of play. How much is that a factor, though, if one manager wants to play a more direct style or another manager wants to play a passing game? Does that really impact on what you do?
Yeah, I think it's a massive, massive component of how a team plays is what type of goalkeeper you have, and it does often get overlooked. If you're a manager who wants to play out from the back and you want to hold a high line, then there's no point bringing in a goalkeeper who's not great with his feet and stays inside his 6 yards box to make saves. You know, it doesn't make sense. You wouldn't sign a winger to play central midfield. So, you know, I think recruitment, especially at this level and probably a couple of leagues up in terms of goalkeepers, need to be looked at a little bit more because there's so many different styles now. It's not just 6'4", I'm going to come and effect crosses and make saves. There's so much more to it now. And I think Pep Guardiola and foreign managers coming to the Premier League, their influence has filtered down the levels, and it's ultimately affected positions. And, you know, most importantly for me and a few others, it affected the goalkeeping position. And I'm in a position now where 10 or 15 years ago I used to, you know, I got subbed at a reserve team game for passing the ball out from a goal kick to my central midfield player, who then passed it back to me and I was able to play out, and it just wasn't the done thing, and I didn't really stick to conformity at the time, and I couldn't understand why. It was, you know, no big deal to me really. I thought the way the game played was that's how it should be, and yeah, fortunately for me, that's the way the game's going now, and I'm finding myself playing again.
you were subbed for doing that. Tell us more about that.
Watford away, Vicarage Road. I remember it. I played a ball into a left winger, but he was playing central midfield. Named Lionel. He was called Lionel Morgan. He's an agent now. He got injured out of the game. He unbelievable talent. Played the ball into him. He was put under a bit of pressure. He played the ball back to me. I was able to take a touch and play it into the forward. And, you know, manager come in at half time with the goalkeeper coach and just said, if you're having to pass the ball into a central midfielder player and he has to give it back to you, you should never have given it to him in the first place. You know, you need to learn your lesson. You're going to watch, I can't remember who replaced me, you're going to watch him second half and see how it should be done. And I was a bit baffled at the time. I couldn't understand why, because, you know, nothing came of it. But I guess back then the risk reward factor was different.
How are you finding the combining the player coach role, and have you taken bits from goalkeeper coaches or managers that have worked with you in the past?
Oh yeah, hugely. Yeah, I'm always learning. I'm always looking at things on social media. I look on websites. I speak to as many goalkeeper coaches as I can. When I moved to the club, I tried to get advice from Glenn Schimmel, from Steve Hale, from Glenn Johnson, you know, goalkeeper coaches at this level and higher, about how I'm going to affect the role positively, how I'm able to work with the other goalkeeper, because it's a really strange role that I'm in terms of, if you're the number two and you're the goalkeeper coach, it's a little bit more simple because you're pushing him and working yourself, but the opposite goalkeeper is the main man. He's the one who's going to be playing. And I had it a lot with Mitra last year where it was perfect because it worked well. We did a lot of video analysis after and I was able to talk to him through it. But then when the roles are reversed and I'm then playing, it is difficult because you've always got half an eye on, is he working hard enough? You know, so now, is Yusuf Mersin working hard enough? Am I doing enough for him, you know, but also looking after myself? So, yeah, it's difficult, it's challenging, but hopefully I'll evolve into a better coach for it.
And as a player, given that you're almost 36 now, how much satisfaction do you take from the fact that you're still going strong, playing regularly at such a good level?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I actually got a message from Steve Watt last night calling me the bionic man. He just said, I don't know how you keep going. I spoke to Jamie Cole this morning. He just said, I don't know how you do it, to be honest, mate. But again, I'm a goalkeeper. They're out for players. And, you know, it's a little bit easier for us. A lot of goalkeepers won't like me saying that. But, you know, physically, it's not as demanding. And it's I keep myself fit. You know, I'm naturally fairly athletic, so that helps. You know, I don't have to worry about my diet too much. I don't put on a lot of weight, but yeah, I mean, it's pleasing. And again, it does, in my opinion, it goes back to how I see the game and how I play the game as a goalkeeper. It's how the manager sees the game should be, how he wants it to be played, how he sees it to be played, and I just fit in. And that is just what it is. And I've given myself a lot of confidence, you know, from end of last season and this season, to feel comfortable at this level. I don't feel as if I'm a stand-in. I feel as if that I'm good enough to be a regular here.
I guess pre-season this year, you probably had a sort of bit of an inkling that you might start the season. But take us back to last season when you become the number one. What kind of discussions were going on behind the scenes between not only you and Mitch, but I guess you're part of the selection process, aren't you, in a way? You know, what was happening between you and Hess at the time?
In terms of selection process for the goalkeeper, I made it quite clear that if he ever was going to put me in the team, it would never be, you know, I'd never come and say, this should happen. Actually, at the time, I did say, I think you need to give me a bit more time to bring out in Mitch what you want from him, because he's an excellent goalkeeper at this level. He's one of the best shot stoppers I've ever seen in training, ever, by far. But it just was a case of getting him to play a little bit of a higher line, which, you know, when you're trying to change the philosophy of a goalkeeper who's played one way for such a long period of time under Chris Kinnear, to then make him completely change that overnight, it's just not going to happen. So it was a case of me trying to work with him, and we were starting to come out in him. The problem was we were running out of time. The games were falling away, and I think we lost 1-0 away at Maidenhead. I wasn't there, my baby girl was getting born that day. And it turns out that there was a bit of a miscommunication. The ball's come over the top. And it was kind of the final straw, I think, in terms of Hesse. For Mitch at that time, he felt that Mitch needed to come out of the team because his own performance was starting to wobble with the pressure that was being put under Mitch to play a certain way. And so I got the phone call. I said, oh, my baby girl's being born. Hesse said, well, congratulations. You're playing against Braintree next week, though. So I said, right, OK, here we go then. So I turned to my wife, who at this point was just in a state of God knows what. I said, I'm playing next week. We had a bit of a laugh and a joke about it, and I remember sort of leaving her to go and play in, because I was playing in a reserve team game on the Tuesday night, and I played in the game, and I've come back. And my Gary Wilson, who the ex-Eastbourne Borough manager, is my father-in-law, and he's there holding the baby, crying. My wife's sort of in tears because obviously she'd only given birth a few days ago. And so it was all a little bit of a whirlwind. I didn't really sleep well that week, and I just thought this could go one way or the other. You know, I could either get to the game and live off adrenaline and play really well, or, you know, this could be the only game I play. Fortunately, I did play really well, saved a penalty, and it capped off the best week of my life, really. You know, I can only describe it as that. And that's how I then managed to live off adrenaline for the following 10 games and got myself to the summer, and we stayed up, and it was all well in the end.
So much for paternity leave, eh? How have you juggled all these things in your life?
It was difficult at the time, just like anyone finds it. I'm a professional footballer, you know, I'm not, you know, a dentist or a doctor or a fireman, or, you know, so you just have to work with it. I do a lot of coaching work around my football as well, with a local football academy called Pro Soccer. So they were good enough. They let me sort of have a lot of time off, because obviously I still had to go to football. I think I just had the Saturday. I was my little girl Grace was born. I was in on the Monday, so I had the Sunday, and then that was it. I was back in, and it was right. This is go time. So aside from the sleeping element, which I'm sure we've all suffered with, it was just a case of trying to get myself through it. But I think the euphoria of having a you know, your firstborn, it sort of took me through and carried me through. And boys were playing well as well, you know, I can't take nothing away from them. We were really hit a lot of form at the time, and, you know, I was just part of a big sort of unit that became successful towards the end of the season and kept the club up.
You're listening to the KM Football Podcast.
What first made you want to be a goalkeeper?
I actually was a left winger when I started playing, and I was probably the size I am now then, when I was under eight, and I just remember I used to score back post headers all the time because I was so tall. But I initially took to being in goal because I wanted to spend a little bit of time with my dad, but I've worked a lot. So he just sort of said, well, let's go and play football. I'll take you to the park every day and we'll go and play football. And I said, oh, I'll go in goal. So I went in goal and I thought, oh, I kind of like this. I don't have to run around. I thought this is quite a good way of me playing here. And my team at the time, my Sunday league team, we rotated. Like, we didn't have a goalkeeper, so we rotated. And I played in a game and I loved it. I enjoyed every minute of it. And I thought, this is excellent. I get to play the game. I don't have to run around as much. And I get to make saves and get muddy. And it was that element to it. That aside with spending a lot of time with my dad every day, that, you know, I dragged him, bless him, down to the park every night of the week, and he just took shots at me, and he tried to coach me in whatever way we found in books and stuff, and it went from there really, and I fell in love with the position immediately. I know it sounds cheesy, but I just did.
So did you just find that you had a talent for it at that time?
Yeah, naturally I was quite good at sort of shot stopping. I was like a lot of goalkeepers, you know, you naturally make saves and it becomes, it's almost second nature to you. Nothing feels awkward. You see some outfield players going goal and you think, oh, they look really awkward. But it felt natural. And I think goalkeepers are a special breed. You either love being a goalkeeper or you really don't. And I loved it. And I loved everything about it. I loved watching it, watching goalkeepers learning. I loved, like I said, getting muddy and all of that side of it. And I sort of took it on from there, really. And it became a hobby as well as, you know, something that I really enjoyed doing, and it then, you know, passion started to become, you know, a little bit more serious as I got to about 11 or 12. So, sort of from then on, it obviously then joined Wimbledon, and it went from there.
You say special breed as goalkeepers. Is it true that they really are bonkers then?
I just think that every goalkeeper has a strange element to his character. I think you'd need to be, because if you actually look at it, you're getting footballs kicked at you and you're trying to stop them from going in a goal, you know, but you're throwing your body in front of a football and you're throwing yourself around on the ground. And yeah, you do find the goalkeepers tend to be a little bit of the off-key characters of the group. I'm one of the more normal ones, and, you know, I'm not that normal.
Do you think that's why you kind of stick together or look out for each other as goalkeepers?
A little bit, I think there's a little bit of a blame the keeper. Everyone thinks that, you know, managers, coaches, outfield players think that they know goalkeeper should have saved that, goalkeeper should have done better there. So you automatically feel that element of brotherhood to the other goalkeeper, and there's nothing worse. You know, when I've ever been playing in the game and I see a goalkeeper the other make a howl or a mistake, you know, I don't feel overjoyed that my team scored. I just think, oh, because I've been there and I know what it feels like and I know how isolated the position is. So there is a keeper's union, if you can call it that, and it's quite a special place, and it's a gloves only type of club.
How old were you when Wimbledon took you onto their books? How did that come about?
I was 11 years old, and I was at the time, I just started playing for my district, which was South East Sussex, because I grew up in Eastbourne and played for my school district. And I remember the day I'd gone down to the park to play football, and it was pouring down with rain. And I just thought, oh, my mum and dad are going to kill me, I'm out in the rain. So I started to run home. I remember seeing my dad's car coming round the corner. I was like, oh, mum, I'm in big trouble now. He pulled over and he said, get in the car, I've got some news. He said, you're going on a trial for Wimbledon. You're going to go and play against Newcastle at Wimbledon, at the training ground. You know, so I just thought, oh, amazing, like, this is brilliant, you know. And it just seemed a natural progression. I naturally always thought that it was going to happen. I know it sounds a bit, not big-headed, but conceited, but I was a very good Sunday league player, so I just thought maybe my next step will be to test myself at a pro club. I went in, I played the game. I did okay from what I can remember, and, you know, they offered me a contract on the spot. So it just so happened that they needed a goalkeeper at the time. They needed someone to fill the under-11 position at the academy, and, you know, that was me. So, yeah, I joined the academy from about 11 years old.
So what memories of your progression up the age groups at Wimbledon, because we're talking kind of crazy gang era, aren't
we? Yeah, it was the crazy gang era, yeah, and it very much so was that. We were kind of sheltered from it from about under 11 to under 16. We played through the age groups, 12s up to 16s, 12s, 14s, 16s, and I was always involved in all the squads, and we had some really good players. Nigel Riakoka was in my youth team from under 12. Dean Lewinson, who's still at MK Dons now. Other players that have played in the league, Joby McEnough, obviously, he was a few years older, Mikhail Leisure. We had a really, really good group of players, and it was a good academy to be at because you got opportunities to play. It was just to travel, you know, and you know, I'll always be grateful to my parents for what they did. They went from Eastbourne up the M23, up the A3, and we trained near Wimbledon, and that was three times a week. So, you know, it takes a lot of sacrifice, and I think when you're a youngster, you don't really know how much they're sacrificing. But, you know, as I grew older, I knew the level that they were committing to me, and I felt as if I should repay them by working as hard as I could. And you obviously worked to 16, and then it's scholarship time. And you know, I was fortunate. I got offered a 5-year contract at 16. It was one of the best moments in my life because I felt as if I'd not just repaid them back, but I'd obviously got through academy football. And at the time, I was signing for full time for a championship club. So, you know, again, it was another in my head a natural progression that was going to be made.
For a young man, a teenager, moving into that environment with the senior players at Wimbledon, what the club was like at that time, how did you find that?
It was brutal. It was it was brutal because I moved out of home and I moved into Diggs, and I had a fantastic Diggs. But you literally, I was born in Eastbourne, I grew up by the coast. I was a bit of a, not a country bumpkin, but I was a bit of a coastal kind of lad. And, you know, I was, you know, all of a sudden I'm living in Sutton, and it was just a bit strange, and it felt almost as if, you know, oh God, what am I doing here? I'm getting, you know, picked up, taken to training. There's all sorts of different types of players and characters, and some big characters. So you had to grow up really quickly. And I thought, you know, obviously I'd been there from 12 to 16, but you're sheltered from the real element of what the crazy game was about. And it made you grow up really quickly. I grew up from 16. Mentally, I was 20 within a few months. I was training because the goalkeepers, we didn't really have a separate goalkeeper coach like academies do now. I was straight in with the first team. So we had Kelvin Davis, who's now the director of football at Southampton, I believe. We had Ian Foyer, who worked with the US national team, and Paul Hild. And Paul Hild played hundreds of league games for various clubs. He really took me under my wing and he really helped me grow as a goalkeeper and give me a lot of abuse along the way. I'll give him that, but it was all done to toughen me up. And I remember it was my 17th birthday, so bear in mind I'd started my scholarship in the June at 16, 17 in December. So I've gone in on my birthday and I'm about to leave, and Kelvin Davis comes out, and Paul Hild comes out, and they said, "You've got something to tell us." I was like, no, what? And they said, "Just be honest, tell us what day it is today and we'll go easy on you." And I remember a few of the boys saying, "Don't tell him, just run. Don't tell him, just run." And I just thought, this is going to happen. No matter what I do, this is going to happen. So I said, "Yeah, it's my birthday today." And they was like, "Right, that's it." So they all grabbed me. They stripped me to my boxer shorts. Bear in mind, it's winter. They stripped me to my boxer shorts. They taped me, full-blown taped me to a free-kick wall, left me out there, and were kicking footballs at me for about 30 minutes. And when I thought, this is over, they come and threw ice on my head. And it was December at the time, and I was freezing. And I was thinking, I can't cry. Like, I cannot cry. Like, I have to hold this in and sort of get my head down through this. And, you know, looking back at it now, you think they'd get arrested. Like, they would come under some serious scrutiny for that now. But it was just the norm. It was the norm at the time. And, you know, eventually, like, they obviously pulled me down, and, you know, it was like, you know, clap round the head and, you know, welcome to the big boys. And, you know, it was all done in a way that just emulated what the club was and toughened me up. And then it maybe I've done a lot of things as well to a lot of the youth team boys below me that I probably shouldn't have done. But it was that. And then I obviously witnessed John Hartson signing, and where they nailed his shoes to the floor and they set a light to his gear. And it was just chaos every day. But that's what the club was built on. And then that's how it flowed. And it was built on that kind of craziness, and it was just seen as the norm. I remember Dean Holdsworth, one of the senior pros, didn't pay his fine. So he had his wheels taken off of his car during training, and his car was left on bricks. And it was just mental, the stuff that you saw at the time. But I mean, it was all moulded you as a person and as a player. And then, you know, you do become tougher in those sort of surroundings. And, you know, maybe that's given me the toughness that I've got, you know, today. You know, if that's how you see it.
Who were the main instigators?
Obviously, Kelvin Davis, Paul Hild, a Northern Irish player called Michael Hughes. A lot of listeners might not remember some of these guys, but Kenny Cunningham, he was always quite, you know, quite a character. And obviously Joby Mekanoff, and you know, they all took it on. All the younger players then took that on to be those sort of players and toughen up the younger group coming through. But again, you had to be tough to play for Wimbledon, because you know that's the sort of club that it was.
You haven't mentioned Vinnie Jones in that list.
Vinnie Jones was one of the best players. Didn't get enough credit for what he was as a player. And I know Vinnie Jones did what he did on the pitch, but off the pitch and at the training ground, I only really had a season or so with him, but he was the nicest guy that I ever came across. You know, he would stay behind after football for an hour, 2 hours, and he'd talk to all the young players. And I know it seems strange, but he would never get involved in any of that towards the young players. He might have done it to the other senior players, but never to the young players. And, you know, I always had a lot of, held him in quite a high regard, not just because of the character that he was on the pitch, but the standards he demanded. Even though it was a crazy club, it still had an element of professionalism, and it was driven by him, essentially. And then that did carry on through other players, but yeah, he was a great character, and really not what you think that he would be in that sense, but an extremely good footballer as well, which he never really got enough credit for.
It's interesting because he's obviously gone on to have a good career in Hollywood. Mm. It sounds like, to a degree, he almost was putting on an act. Then once he crossed the white line and it was game time, then Match Day Vinny came out.
Doesn't surprise me at all. His personality was huge, and he had an. They say, you know, I've not really had the chance to meet many actors or anything, but they say they have an aura, and he kind of had the aura. Had it about him. He just, when he was in the room, you knew he was there. It was the, you know, that kind of scenario. So, but like I said, I was lucky enough to have him for a season, and I was only a first year scholar, so no, I didn't. You know, we weren't best friends.
You were at the club during their move from Wimbledon to Milton Keynes. How do you reflect on that period?
It was really tough, and it was tough because I was in it from the sense of everybody from the outset saw it as it's Franchise FC. They're ruining the football club. They're going to change football because Pete Winkelmann's taken port in the club to Milton Keynes. But as players at the time, I hadn't finished the current contract that I was at. I was on at the time, but I was getting a new contract, so they were giving us all new pro contracts, and it was so I'd agreed a new three-year contract there at the time. Out of the blue, at this point we were owned by Norwegian owners. Egil Olsen was our manager, and they'd overspent, and the club had got to a point where he was trying to go away from what it was, and maybe that was what it needed to be to stay in the Premier League, or how the new owners thought that they needed to take it. But we come in one day, and the Norwegian owner was there, and he said, there's no money left. Like, no money. You're not getting paid tomorrow. There's nothing left. We was all a bit shocked. I was a bit, well, I've just signed a new contract. Like, it's payday tomorrow. I was only a young pro. None of us were on fortunes. And he said, we're going to try and sell the club, but as of tomorrow, administrators will be coming in, and, you know, they'll be doing what they can to dismantle it. So the club instantly went into administration, like instantly, and it really affected everyone working there. Bear in mind, you had a lot of staff who'd worked there for a long time. You had a big playing staff, and just within weeks, players got sold. Adam Noland, who was signed for Blackpool, went to West Ham. Joby Mekanoff, I believe, either went to Palace or Reading, and people were just going off in different directions, and all of a sudden we were left with just a fragile team as such of what was left of the younger pros and what they could bring in and around what the administration would let them. And then all of a sudden, obviously, the Milton Keynes situation come up. So it was a case of that or nothing. And, you know, I've got nothing but respect for what everyone's done at AFC Wimbledon and how quickly and how far they've taken that football club. But at the time, from my perspective, the only answer was to go to Milton Keynes. You know, none of us were prepared to suddenly drop 10 divisions of B Park players and build the way back up. We had careers to think about, and the only way we saw any progression was to go to Milton Keynes. So Pete Winkelmann come in full of energy, full of everything of what you see that he is. Just quickly, I was fortunate enough when I was at Maidstone and we played MK Dons, he was the first person to greet me off the bus, the first man to come down and remember me. And I didn't expect him to remember me. I wasn't there that long in the changeover. I had already made my move. And he was, so that just shows the pedigree of the man in my eyes. But we made the move to Milton Keynes. We still trained in Wimbledon at the training ground. We played our home games at the hockey stadium. but again with a squad that was quite fragile. But I was then propelled into the first team squad at a Championship club, which is where I thought it would take me years at the time to get to. So all of a sudden I'm on the bench in the Championship, getting loads of experience behind Steve Banks, who went on to play for Gillingham. And so, it, you know, although the situation wasn't great and we didn't get paid for a few months at a time, and it did propel my experience side of my game, and I learnt a lot, and it did mould me as a character.
How did you find the period of time, the few years after you left Wimbledon? Because you had a bit of time here and a bit of time there, didn't you?
When I was at Wimbledon, I mean, like many young players, I just, in my head, my pathway was youth team, reserve team, sit on the bench, play in the Championship. That was my pathway in my head. I had no other plan, no other ideas that it was going to be any different. I really didn't. Very naively, of course, not knowing the world, not knowing the football world as it was, overestimating my ability and my physicality at the time. But that was how I saw it. That was just how my career had gone to that point. So when I left Wimbledon, my confidence took a knock. But I left, and earlier in that season, I spent some time on loan at Wickham. So I managed to get a few games in League One. So I built up a kind of a playing experience there under Tony Adams for a month. And I managed to secure a move to Rushden & Diamonds, who at the time were owned by Max Griggs, the guy who owned Dr. Martins. Still putting a lot of his own money in to a fantastic training ground. Fantastic ground. And it was two staff who were my reserve team manager and first team coach for a time when I was at Wimbledon in Ernie Tippett. And Stuart Robson, the ex-Arsenal centre-half, they'd gone to Rushden, so they invited me in on trial. It wasn't a secure contract. They invited me on trial, and I'd done really well, and I was signed as the number two behind Billy Turley. Fortunately for myself, again, another goalkeeper coach that has moulded me up to now was Alan Hodgkinson, who came in, who was the goalkeeper coach at Man United, who spoke to Peter Schmeichel. So this guy comes in, albeit coming to the end of his career, and you know, an older guy, and you know, I'd obviously got a chance to work with Alan for the season. And again, I was at a point where I just thought, right, now this could be where I now pick up my career and I now kick on. And Billy Turley got suspended, failed a drugs test, got suspended. So this was me now. I got my opportunity. We played Oxford United at home, Boxing Day, and lost 3-0. But I played okay. I thought I did well. I thought, right, I now need to build on this. Can I build my experience in League Two and sort of go from there? I was at a great club, like I said, with a great training ground, great fan base. It was going one way again. So this is my time to shine. I played about 5, 6, 7 games, I believe. Played Leighton Orient away, and I'd had an excellent game. I was making saves here, there and everywhere. And I had a colossal last-minute moment where the centre-half, I think it was the centre-half, come up for a corner and he'd shot. Our centre-half blocked it with the bottom of his boot. The ball spanned right up in the air. I've jumped, it's probably on the blooper video somewhere, I've jumped to touch the crossbar confidently thinking it's gone over. Landed back down. As I've landed, the ball's landed with me and bounced into the roof of the net. And it was 2-2. And I literally, my heart sank, because I'd had one of these moments where I thought, this could kill me, this. I'm a young goalkeeper, I've built myself up for the last 7, 8, 9, however many games I've played, but this situation could sort of step me back again. And it really, that moment hit me really hard, because I just thought, I'm trying to bounce back here and I just seem to be getting pegged back. And then, like any player, you know, you get seeds of doubt. You know, am I ready for first team football? Is this the way, is this my direction? And maybe, you know, I need to look at, you know, maybe sitting on the bench again for a couple of years or whatever. So you start, then the seeds of doubt come, and they ended up bringing a couple of goals. Scott Shearer on loan from Coventry, who was another excellent character to work with. I really like Scott. Anyway, he ended up staying and I believe playing for the rest of the season, in which time the two managers got sacked and was replaced by Barry Hunter. He had no interest in me whatsoever. And, you know, I went in for the meeting at the end of the season, and it was, you know, thanks but no thanks, we're not going to extend your contract. And found myself on a train on the way back to Eastbourne, and I was thinking, you know what, you know, I'm now 22, 23, what go, you know, which direction do I go now? This wasn't what was supposed to happen. This wasn't, you know. And I think from 11 to that moment, I built myself up to, I was going to be a professional footballer in the Championship. You know, that was the direction it was going to go in. it hadn't, and it was, I wasn't ready for it. I hold my hands up and say I really wasn't ready for that moment, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. And
I don't know if you could be ready for that moment, though, could you? I mean, by 22, could you have prepared yourself?
Yeah, I think you get worried at the time, because you then start to think, 18, your friends go off to university, they're then finishing with degrees, they're starting their life. Where I was maybe 18, I was starting, I'd got loads of experience, I'd been, you know, working as such and earning money from 17, 18, and, you know, I'd got a lot of life experience. I'd, you know, played in, you know, the Wales under-19s, and, you know, I'd travelled a bit of Europe, and then I was almost back to square one, and I just thought, I'm now 4 years behind everyone else. You know, can I really keep taking these knockbacks? What do? Do I fill my suitcase and go on trial again somewhere else? You know, I didn't know. I didn't know what to do, because, you know, I was at a stage where I don't think even my parents thought that I was going to do anything different. You know, I hadn't had that preparation either. So, maybe you can't be ready, but, you know, for a 22, 23-year-old, it was scary at the time.
It's the cruelest of examples as well, isn't it? That a goalkeeper, you are the last line of defence. If you make a mistake, it is magnified more than anyone. A striker can miss a chance.
This is it.
No one knows, but if you drop a clang like that, you've dropped points.
This is it, yeah. Yeah, you've dropped points, and can you be trusted? I'm at a position now where I look down on younger players and goalkeepers, and you can see yourself in some of them, and you think, maybe they're not ready yet. Maybe I wasn't ready at the time, and I wish I'd had more of a support network. Not my family were excellent, but more of a football support network to help me through that period might have been an easier transition for me. But I was just, again, maybe not ready for first team football. Maybe if the 23 situation was around then like it is now, that might have been a better fit for me. But I was also a bit unlucky, because I had the Wimbledon situation. You know, they'd gone bankrupt as such. I got sent on loan to Wickham, started playing games, got brought back. I'd gone to Rushden, manager got sacked, you know, so it all wasn't quite flowing.
You mentioned the loan at Wickham, playing under Tony Adams.
Yeah.
Tell us a bit about that experience.
that was pretty crazy, in a sense that I'd spent some time training there because I wasn't sure. I'd asked if I could go and train at other clubs because I wasn't sure what Wimbledon were going to do. So I said, you know, I need to secure something. I'd like to go and train with them. But then their goalkeeper got in, I think two goals, they had a really strange goalkeeping situation where the youth team keeper got injured, the two first team keepers got injured, they couldn't sign anyone league-wise, I don't know what the rules were at the time, but they could sign me on a youth loan, or I don't know how it worked, but I was kind of their only option, and we were bottom of the league, and they were getting relegated anyway, so it was just a case of I was going to go in and play some games. First game, played at home to Swindon, lost 3-1, but got man of the match. So that was a really, really positive, you know, it was a good start for me. But we'd lost 3-1 and we were bottom, and gone into the change room after the game, and, you know, Tony Adams just stood there and he said, you know, you've all done well. I'll see you Friday. And I thought, Friday? It's Saturday. He said, I'll see you Friday. So I punched from the boys, see you Friday. He said, yeah, he said, Gaffer enjoys his holidays, so we'll probably all go off to Marbella as well, so you might as well just tell your club that that we're in, and you have some time off as well. So I can't do that. So I went in and went back in training again Friday. Consequently, we played on Saturday, lost again. Same situation. See you Friday. It was a bit odd. It was all a bit strange. I wasn't there long enough to really understand. I mean, it was excellent working and seeing him as a character, because he really wasn't, again, wasn't what I thought he was going to be. But it was strange, because all this Friday tactical, technical stuff was very good. This session was very good. It just, maybe there was other stuff going on behind the scenes I wasn't aware of. But yeah, it was a bit odd.
For the latest reaction and reports from the games that matter, visit our website at kentonline.co.uk.
Walks, we've seen you over the last decade or so, you know, become one of the most recognisable faces in Kent football. You've had a really good career playing in goal for Tunbridge, Maidstone, Dover. But how did you get from that point where you didn't know what direction your career, your life was going in, to getting on the right route?
So I sat, my parents had a beach house, a small, very, really small beach house. I'm making it sound better than what it is. Really small beach house down on the coast in Eastbourne. And I sat on the deck and I said to my dad, I'm going to join the Navy. And he went, you what? I said, I need to do something else. I'm going to join the Navy. And he said, you were last in the Navy. I said, well, I need to do something. I need to get my mind on something else. I need to go and get my career on track. And I did look into it, and I went a little bit down the line, but never, it sort of fizzled out. But yeah, it's funny you should say this. I got in touch with my now father-in-law, Gary Wilson at Eastbourne Borough, and I just said, Gary, I was wondering if you could help me. I'd like to come down and train. I know you've obviously got Lee Hook there, who went on to Dover, but you know, I need a club to train at over the summer and maybe play some games. You know, would that be a possibility? Yeah, brilliant. Come down. So I went down and I trained and done really well, and I really enjoyed it. And I, you know, it was a really professional setup. The club was really local, and I just thought maybe I could get myself in at this level and see where it takes me. Stupidly looking down from being a professional player at the time, looking down on non-league and thinking I can just waltz in here and be the main man. And I sort of went into training, and Lee Hook was an excellent keeper, and he was firmly in as the goalkeeper, but again, my naive mind didn't see it that way. And I got a bit of a chip on my shoulder about it at the time. And I remember we went to Bishop Stortford playing. I was on the bench, and again had the hump about it. Come back, and I sort of said to Gary at the time, who years later we were obviously going to rekindle, so I'm not having this. I should be playing, you know, I've been at such and such a club, I should be playing. So I said, well, you've got to bide your time, keep working, you know, and we might get you into some cup games and see, you know, see how you go from there. And again, my old head thought, well, I'm not having this. Then out of the blue, ridiculously out of the blue, because obviously while I was at Rushden, I was called into the Wales under-21s. So once you're called into the squad at that time, you're then part of the squad. No matter what happens with you club-wise, you could probably retire, but they'd keep you in the squad. You were in the squad for 2 years. That's just the way they worked it. So although I didn't have a club, I was still in the 21s in the European Championship squad. So out of the blue, I got a call from Cardiff, from a guy called Paul Wilkinson. We need a third choice. Do you want to come down and trial, and we'll have a look at you? Again, very stupidly, I ignored all my calls from Gary. And eventually texted him and just said, listen, I'm going to go to Cardiff just to have a go and see what it's like. And yeah, okay, no problem. Probably must have hated me for just leaving him at a loose end with no other goal, you know, other than Hookie there. So I went down to Cardiff, and there was Neil Alexander there, Martin Margotson, who's obviously now the England goalkeeper coach, and George Wood, who was the ex-Arsenal keeper. He was the goalkeeper coach. Anyway, I had a really, really good session on the Monday. I trained really well. Everything just worked. I trained brilliantly. Come in after that, he said, oh, Dave Jones was the manager, pulled me in. He just said, sort of quite flippantly, oh, we want to sign you. I was like, all right. God, this is a big upturn in events, this. You know, been released from a League Two club and been training with a Conference South club, and now I'm signing for a Championship club as the third choice. It just all seemed a bit odd, but the chairman at the time wanted anyone who was Wales under-21s, he wanted to sign them, so Swansea didn't sign them. It was that kind of rivalry. But so he signed me. I got a really good contract there and signed me. So all of a sudden, I then was at Cardiff for the year, training with the first team, playing in the reserves, travelling with the first team. I ended up staying there, and I did think that again, that might be the pathway that I might take. But I was in Cardiff, I was single, I was living on my own. I possibly let my lifestyle get the better of me a little bit and probably should have been more professional. George, probably a few too many nights out, and you know, again, I can hold my hands up, I probably could have been better and done more to stay at the club, but sort of come to it, and they wanted to go a different direction, and I was then released, and at the end of that season I'm back on the phone to Gary again. Back on the phone to Gary, still in the Wales under-21 squad at this point, crazily enough, and ended up going back training with Eastbourne again for the summer. Got to the end of the summer, again stopped playing, and I didn't play again until October. So I stopped playing. I gave up. I was at the point where I was the previous year, where do I want to just fill another suitcase up? I got a phone call from Forest Green and one or two other clubs, but I'd had enough again. So I was working for a friend. Me and him ran a coffee and cocktail bar in Eastbourne, and I was kind of enjoying not playing football and living in the real world. And I got a phone call from Nigel Kane, who was a manager at Hastings, saying, we need a goalkeeper, desperate for one, are you available? I said, no, sorry Nigel, I've stopped playing, not interested. Apologies, but you know, I'm not really playing anymore. He kept phoning and kept phoning and kept phoning. So I said, listen, I'll come and train once, and I'll play for you on the Saturday if you need a goalkeeper. But after that, you know, I'm not interested. Went down and trained, really enjoyed it, loved the session, and I've met up with a few, Tim Olerunda, Adi Olerunda, and some players who I played with at junior football were there as senior players, and played Croydon Athletic on the Saturday in the FA Trophy. We won 3-1. And I think it was everything to do with turning up to the ground. And I looked at this, it's quite a, it's an old stadium, but it's quite a big stadium at Hastings, and it's the big stand, and I just thought, I'm number one at this club. And even though it's quite a small thing in football terms, when I'd done what I'd done, and you know, and I was, you know, the grand world of football, it gave me a big sense of, you know, maybe this is what I need, maybe this is the confidence boost that I need, I can get some games here. And I thought, let's just see how it goes. Played Chatham on the Tuesday night, lost 7-0. But that didn't deter me, and I absolutely loved playing at Hastings. I loved it was close, I was playing every week, I was seen as the number one, and we ended up having an amazing season that year. We ended up winning the Ryman South playoffs. We played Dover in the semi-final, won 2-0, played Tooting and Mitcham in the final, won 2-0 again, and you know, we were promoted, and it was a year of foundation, and I'll always have a lot of time for that football club and Nigel Kane, and my brother-in-law at the time was the first team coach there, Gareth Smith. I'll always have a lot of time for them as people, because they've propelled me into the position I'm in now in football terms.
You went on to have 5 years at mm-hmm. Tunbridge Angels. How much did you enjoy that?
I loved it. I think anyone, I don't know if you've had Tommy in yet, but he came to my wedding. I love Tommy to pieces. Tommy's got this weird knack about him of making you just love him as a person, as a football man. You want to play for him. So I remember I got a phone call from Tommy. It was through Anthony Story, who was playing at Tunbridge, and we lived in Eastbourne. I did a little bit of coaching work with him, and he called me up and he said, hello Wargs, like he does, get yourself up to Tunbridge, I'll show you around the ground, and we'll have a beer and we'll talk about maybe signing you. Sounded a bit Harry Redknapp-ish, so I thought, yeah, all right. So I turned up, and Tommy stood there in his short shorts, white flip-flops, big sunglasses on. Hello, Sam. So hello, Tommy, and he showed me around the ground as if it was like Wembley. And he said, this is, you know, this is my plans for the club. This is how I want to play. This is what I want to do. This is where I want to take it. And I just loved his enthusiasm, loved his football knowledge, thought I could really improve with this man. He had a great assistant in Cliff Cant with him, great football man. Terry Sedge was there, he was a goalkeeper coach, and it was just a brilliant move for me in terms of my career progression, and the professionalism side of my football went up a notch. Having the 5 years there as again, fond memories of the club. We had obviously had the promotion into the Conference South at the playoff final. But I played with, you know, people I make friends for life, in Franny Collin and, you know, Dan Walder and, you know, Lee Browning, and obviously Addy and Tim Olerunda followed me to Tunbridge, and it was a great time to play football at that club. And it was again playing with Tommy. I smile when I say his name. He's one of them sort of guys, and like I said, I still speak to him now. And it was just difficult, because we obviously got promoted into the Conference South. We had a good 2 years there, but like Tommy, I felt as if it was 5 years was enough, and obviously shows that, because I spent 5 years at Maidstone. But yeah, 5 years was the time when, you know, maybe I needed to move in a different direction. But I'll always hold on to those 5 years at Tunbridge. There's some amazing memories with playing with some excellent players. You know, I played with obviously Carl Rook and Scott Goodin. I could literally, the list is endless, but it was, you know, it was a great time to be there.
When you moved up the road to Maidstone, you ended up playing almost 250 consecutive league games. How proud are you of what you achieved individually there and also as the team?
Yeah, I mean, I always thought to myself, I want to walk through the door, and when I eventually leave, I want to leave the place in a better situation than what I found it. That was what I wanted to do, because when I was at Tunbridge the previous season, me and Terry Sedge went to a game there, and they played against Eastbourne Town, and I'd not been to the new stadium, and I turned up and I just thought, wow, this place is is going places. This is incredible. Well, you know, this is the Ryman South. They had about 1,600 there. The place was buzzing with excitement. The game was terrible. I think it was 0-0, but the place was buzzing with excitement. I just thought, I want a piece of this. You know, if I can get myself here, this would be where I need to now take my career. It just so happens that me and my wife were moving to the town because my wife's a corporate lawyer and she was doing a training contract at a company in the town at the time. So I sort of tentatively let Jay know for a direct message on Twitter that I was available, and he come back to me with, if we win the playoff final and get promoted, we'd love to bring you in. So it sort of went from there. And
were you there on the day of the playoff final?
No, I just thought it would have been a bit weird or a bit disrespectful to go to the final, I think Darren or Charlie Mitten were playing at the time, and I just thought, you know, I'm going to leave it. And I actually fell asleep on my sofa at home and woke up and saw it's 3-0. I thought, well, I know where I'm going next season then. And it was almost done. The situation was done in my head. And although I left Tunbridge with a really heavy heart, because, you know, it's probably not, you know, the best move to make, Tunbridge to Maidstone. There's quite a bitter rivalry, but, you know, their club needed to move in a different direction. So did I personally. And it was a club, looking back at my Maidstone years now, that it was a big part of my life, huge, huge part of my life, my family's life. I loved being there. I'm only proud of everything that we achieved, because to take a football club from the Ryman Premier to the National League in 5 years, 4 years, no, 3 years or whatever it was, it's incredible. And I'll always be proud to have just played a small part in that journey.
I think you half answered it then, but I was going to say, was it sort of almost hard in a way to leave Tunbridge? But it wasn't, because by the sounds of it, you saw yourself going anyway. You know, you were the one orchestrating the move out.
Yeah, the sort of character that I am, I'm very all in. So when I was at Tunbridge, I was all in Tunbridge, and I lived and breathed it, and I'd give everything to every minute of the time that I was there. But I'm the sort of person as well that once the door's closed and it's done, that chapter's finished and I can move on. And although I had amazing memories there and I loved it, I know personally when it's time to move on. And I think little dips in form, little lapses in concentration, which were starting to appear in my game at the end of my Tunbridge career, I thought, right, I need, again, a different scenery, a different voice, a different manager. You know, I needed different. And when that door closed and, you know, my Maidstone door opened, and it was difficult, but it wasn't in the same breath, because it was good for them and it was good for me.
And there were so many highlights at Maidstone, obviously.
I could sit here and go through them, you know, minute by minute. But it was, you know, winning the Ryman Premier with that group of players and playing how we did and achieving what we did in terms of the FA Cup. To win a league, any league, is the most difficult thing to do in football, because you're the best team and you're the ones that have won more games, got more points, played better than everyone else. We incorporated that into a brilliant FA Cup run, and it was kind of moulded what the club was. And that to me, looking back at that time, was what Maidstone was and what it needs to be built on again when they regroup themselves and you know, make their own history, the people that are there now. But at the time, that dressing room was, I'd never been in anything like it. It was mental. And I've made friends for life. And when you're playing with people that you then go and have a meal with on a Sunday, and you're good friends with, in similar situation to what I had at Hastings, and it makes it so much more special. And when you're doing it at a club with a fan base like they had, and everyone was just pulling in the same direction, and when you've got that sort of pull and that sort of attendances and fan base and people that lived and breathed the club, it was like I said, it was amazing to be part of the journey and, you know, meet the characters that I did, because I did meet a few of them.
Throughout that period, you were basically ever present. Mm-hmm. Hardly missed a single minute of any game.
Mm-hmm.
How often do you think during that time or through your career were there games when you probably weren't quite right or 100% fit, but you said to the manager, I'm playing?
A lot of times, yeah, a lot. You can be injured and
you're injured and you're not playing. You're not getting up, you're not walking out of the room. Or you're injured and it goes away once the warm-up starts. And I was one of them where, yes, I do feel little injuries and my groin's a bit sore, and but I was always mentally ready that I wanted to play. I wanted to play every minute of every game. I had the hunger that I just loved playing football, and I loved playing at that club, and I loved playing in front of the fans. And I was scared to miss minutes because I didn't want to miss any moments. And don't get me wrong, I was extremely fortunate with injuries. And extremely fortunate to have a fantastic medical team at Maidstone, like we do now have at Dover, who look after you, and a good club that look after you in that respect. But I've got, it's just a mindset for me. And if you want to play, then, you'll make sure that you do.
Now, there are moments in every player's career and games that you'll look back on when you retire, and you'll be remembered for them, and kind of iconic images. I'm sure you know where we're going with this.
Yeah, I know where we're going with this.
The playoff final at Ebbsfleet. Just take me back there to your memories of that day.
It was a very, very strange situation because we were on the bus, and Jay Saunders, who's one of my good friends in football, and he's an excellent man manager, had this amazing ability to literally take the pressure out of any situation and make it seem as if we were just going to play a pre-season game. Like, he literally, it was his character that day, in my opinion, won us the final, because he was so calm throughout the whole. He was calm, but in a sense of, you're good enough to win this. They're all writing you off. I'm not putting any pressure in. There's no pressure on any of us. But in this dressing room, we're more than good enough to win this. And he had the essence of it. And it started from the coach journey. He was very much like a coach. And I don't know what I expected, but I expected a bit more of a tense kind of character, maybe. Maybe I should have known him better because I've known him long enough. But, he was very smiley, laughy, jokey. And it was the same Jay Saunders that I'd seen when we'd gone to Harrowborough away. And it was, there's a different feel into this. And we got into the changing room, and it was a great occasion to be part of. I remember my whole family were there, and I just thought, whatever happens today, this is a hell of an achievement. We've bounced into these playoffs off of the back of an amazing 17 game or 18 game run, I think it was, and didn't concede a goal for 11 of the games, and got into them anyway. We somehow stumbled into the playoffs, which is effectively what we did. And the changer, and I remember sort of half coming out of the change room, and there was an opera singer at the time.
Yes, there was an opera singer in the sense.
It kind of made you feel like, wow, this is a real event. This is an event.
It was the perfect storm, wasn't it? Because it was the local rival, the promotion prize, the occasion. Probably the fact you were going to their ground.
It's a David and Goliath kind of situation. Although we were essentially a big club with good support, They were the sort of, the big hitters, and, the big names. And we were just there, not there to make up the numbers, but I think that's how a lot of people outside of it saw the game. We sort of, in our minds, listen, I talk about Jay being relaxed, but we were prepared. We were fully prepared to go into the game. We knew the game plan. We knew points of the pitch that we needed to expose and what we needed to do to get into the game. And I'll be honest with you, I thought we were the better team. The goal, penalty come against the run of play. And that's sort of how the game goes. You just sort of thought, they've got a penalty, they've got another penalty. This isn't going to go our way. And I didn't particularly have a great game myself. I didn't have loads to do. I mean, made the odd save, but he'd scored two penalties against me, which I was livid about, because I'd spent the whole week knowing that a final was probably a time when a referee would give a penalty on what he was going to do. And I remember watching Danny's bloody penalties at the playoff final for Wimbledon, and where he'd smashed it down the middle. And I thought, if he's in a final, that's what he's going to do. And I remember being stood there for the first penalty, and I did stand up for the first one, and he put it to my bottom left, and I dived because I thought, I can't stand there, I look stupid, so I need to fall. So I've done that. And then the second penalty, he went down the middle, and I dived to the left, and I just thought, he's mentally, he's got me here. second penalty come against us, which I thought was a really harsh one, but the referee had Stuart Lewis in his ear all game. And at the time, I didn't know Stu that well, but I've gone to love him. We're really, really good friends now. But yeah, I just thought, this guy is killing us. Like, he's just shouting at the referee, and he got them another penalty, and it was 2-1. Anyway, I think we made a couple of subs, and it got to sort of the 87th, 88th minute, and we were passing the ball around, and I was thinking, what are we doing? Let's just get it up there. Let's you know, there's 2 minutes left. We need to get something from this game. Fortunately, we were kicking into our end, and the crowd were getting louder and louder, and we were playing it around, and all of a sudden, the ball went into the box, and it was bobbing around. I think someone hit a shot, and I think Atch blocked it Atch and Pong blocked it, and all of a sudden, it bounced down to Didi. Yeah, Didi. Yeah, Didi's on fire. Yeah, he scored. And I just thought, oh my God, this is extra time, and we've scored in the last minute of extra time. And there was only one winner, in my opinion, at that point. I just thought, there is no way, mentally, you can drag yourself back from that moment. And I was pretty pretty calm and collective at that time. And I think I must have been in a bit of a zone, because obviously the penalties were going through. I think I saved the third one, Bonner's penalty. Yeah, he was very. I remember him put the ball down and he smiled, and I think it was a nervous smile. But I thought he looks quite cocky, like, and he sort of wandered up to the ball and passed it, and I saved it with my legs. I just thought, oh, here we go. You know, we're you know, this is. Going in the right direction. But I remember my mind being really blank because I couldn't hear much noise. And
what's it like when the absolute player or the opposition player is walking up with the ball, you're getting ready in goal to face a penalty? Are you looking at their facial expression or how they are?
Yeah, I'll always look at their facial expression because I want to know if they're confident or not. Some will put their head down and they won't give anything away. They'll give you a good poker face. But you can tend to get a feeling of he's confident, he's not confident by their stature, the way they stand. You know, yeah, are they looking at you? And I just thought the Bonner was quite too confident, but, you know, it turns out that maybe he just really was a bit nervous.
And also, not the person you would expect to take a penalty.
No, this is it. Yeah, I thought it was probably a bit harsh on him, really, unless he asked to take it. It was probably, a bit harsh to put a centre-half taking the penalty, but... Yeah, then obviously we then missed our next one. So I just thought, well, we're even Stevens again. And then it was goal. And then I didn't know Kedwell's was the last penalty. I had no idea because I wasn't keeping count of the penalties. I was just waiting for Kedwell to come because I thought, right, I'm just going to stand it because there's no way in a million years you're going to change now. So I had a conversation, funnily enough, as well with Will Godman, who was the number two at the time, and I just said to him, I said, I'm going to stand there. He said, yeah, I was going to say, just stand. So I thought, right, I'm just going to stand there because if he scores it, you know, I don't even know what I thought. In my head, we could have even lost it if he'd scored it. I didn't know, but I just thought, right, I'm just going to stand. So I stood, and he's running up, and he's just drilled it, and I've just stood still. And the ball's sort of coming towards my head. I just remember thinking, save it or it's going to hit you. You know, it's going to hit your face. So I sort of saved it, and the ball's gone up in the air. And it sounds strange, but I was more worried about it bouncing back into the net. So I sort of watched it bounce away. And then I sort of turned to then go and walk back to where I was standing and let Ashmore come in. And everyone started running towards me, and then it hit me. I thought, we've won this. And then I've obviously found pace that I've never found again or never had before and managed to run round, and it was... Yeah, I'll look back on it in years to come, and I do now, that it was my moment in football, my epic moment that I'll always remember. Now I'll never forget that moment, that feeling, and to take the club that I'd been at for sort of 3 years up, and to do that for a manager who deserved it, and a fan base that deserved it, effectively, possibly to the detriment of the club at the end, because it cost a lot of money to be in the National League, but we didn't care. I didn't care at the time because it was a moment that I'll never forget.
Do you think there might still be one more moment like that in your career? Could David take you to a playoff?
Never say never in football. You can. All I'll say with this group of players is that we're a very, very good group. We're very strong. We're good in all areas. We've got an excellent manager who is excellent, by the way. I've seen, it's opened my eyes being part of a management team and seeing a manager at work and his in-game stuff I've never really seen a lot of it before because I've always been playing, but his in-game substitutions and readings of games and help from, you know, Darren Herr and Nicky and the subs that they make that 9 times out of 10 do work, it's amazing to see. And the way he drives you on, it can be tiring at times, but he gets the best out of people, and he no doubt will get the best out of this squad. And like I said, in football, you never say never. I've surprised myself by being in the team Saturdays. You know, I never would have said it 12 months ago that I'd be playing for another club in the National League. So I can't say that we won't have another epic moment again.
Is there a manager inside Lee Morgan? I know you're just starting out on the coaching path, but when you look at, you know, you talk about Hess and what he does, is there a bit in the back of your mind that one day that could be you making those decisions?
I think as a people person, as a character that I'm very good with people and building relationships, I'd need to learn a lot about the in-game stuff from, you know, what I've seen. I think everybody thinks they can be a football manager. I think everybody will sit in the armchair and say, oh, I wouldn't pick him, or, you know, I would have made that substitution. I guess being in the role is a lot harder than what it looks. But I'm learning. I've learned off of a lot of very, very good managers in the past, and I'm building a portrait of what a good manager should be. Whether I take that step in the future, I don't know. I'm very, very keen on learning and being a better goalkeeper coach, and really working on that, and, you know, moulding that part of my coaching aspect at the moment. But I'd, like I said, never say never in football. I'd never rule it out. So I'll have to see how, you know, what the future holds, and sort of go from there, really.
And you mentioned the switch earlier from Tunbridge to Maidstone. We've touched on the move from Maidstone to Dover.
Mm-hmm.
Dare I say you'd be manager of Ebbsfleet. It's such a strange sort of, you know, the moves that you've made. You've crossed the barriers, haven't you?
Yeah, I've crossed the barriers. Like I said, I'm an all or nothing person, and I know when there's time for change. And football's the strangest world, that when you're in it, it seems the norm. When you're out of it, it must just seem crazy, the things that you see on a day-to-day basis. But stuff happens that you'd never think possible. You know, 6 months ago, I never would have thought Darryl McMahon would be manager at Macclesfield, but here we are today, and he is. And it's crazy. It's a crazy sport to be involved in, and that's what I love about the game. Whatever level I can be involved in, I love the spontaneity of it. I love the passion that it gives me, and it lights a fire that inside me. And, you know, hopefully I can always be involved in the sport in a capacity, because it's in my blood, and, you know, I hope it stays there.
Quick fire questions, Lee.
Okay.
That's like my first one.
Yep.
What's more nerve-wracking, penalty shootout against Ebbsfleet or trying to make up with Gary Wilson so you can...
trying to make up with Gary Wilson was the single most scariest thing in my life, yeah. And it took me about 6 months, but we're very, very close now, so yeah, it's all good.
Favourite ground that you've played at?
Tranmere. Loved playing at Tranmere. I just thought that, I think it was at the time when we was little Maidstone, it was our first year, and you turn up to Tranmere, and we turned up in a minibus. They wouldn't let us in because they thought we were supporters. And yeah, it felt like an amazing ground to play football at. But I've got to say as well, I did love Sinsel Bank, because it was in the Cowley time when they were really on a roll. And you know what those two guys are like, the place was jumping. And, you know, even though we lost 2-0, that was a good occasion.
As a goalkeeper, you're often the first one in line to take a bit of stick from the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
What ground either have you taken the worst stick from, or what are the funniest things that you've heard from behind your goal?
My nose always takes a battering, that goes without saying. People always think that they're the first person to said that your name's spelt upside down. It should be Morgan, not Wogan. Terry Wogan, I get a lot. I get that from Danny Blaw, actually. I don't know if you know Danny. He was assistant manager at Eastbourne just recently. Yeah, he always calls me Terry. Again, thinks it's the first time he said it. Canvey Island, I would have to say, was the worst. They were brutal. Very, very brutal. But yeah, most grounds will give you a bit of stick, but I've learnt in my older age to, if you smile, laugh along with what they're saying and give them a clap at the end, you tend to walk away the winner anyway.
Favourite save that you've ever made, apart from the Keds penalty shootout one?
Well, now this sounds like there's too many to mention, but no, it's not that at all. My favourite save would have to be under the when Harry Wheeler was manager of Maidstone, a shot was fired in and it flicked off Simon Walton's head and went back the other way. And I didn't think I would save it either, but I managed to get a fingertip to it and push it around the post. And then I'd have to say my save, my tip onto the bar last season, my first game for Dover, against Braintree. The tip of the free kick, tip onto the bar again, because I didn't think I was going to get there, and I did. So they were two saves that stick in the memory.
Every good goalkeeper relies on a couple of good centre-halves. Make the Dover players that are currently in the squad exempt just for selection purposes.
Yeah.
Who's the best centre-half that you've played behind?
Stephen Watt. He's definitely up there, because his understanding of... I use him as an example a lot, actually, because of his understanding of how to protect a goalkeeper in terms of if I ever called and I was coming out or coming out for a corner, he would protect you. Whereas a lot of centre-halves, strangely, don't do that and you end up taking a whack or you get smashed. He was excellent, and his communication and his character made him excellent. Alex Winter, who I played with at Maidstone, was excellent. He was very good, could play absolutely anywhere across the back four, and a great character, and I still speak to him now. And Scott Goodin, who I played with at Tunbridge, who's possibly the most underrated player I ever played with. Scotty was a league player. He was 9 out of 10 every single week, and it probably, if it wasn't for a couple of bad knee injuries, would have definitely found his way either to this level or higher.
Just finally, 36 coming up. We won't say go into too much detail, but you're getting on a bit in goalkeeping terms.
Yeah, yeah.
How many more years do you think you've got left to play? Certainly at National League level.
Well, last year I would have said would have been my last one, but I surprised myself. Oh, I've got to say, physically I feel in excellent shape. My game has evolved with my age, so you adapt yourself to your surroundings and your game has to change. But I just want to keep playing. Again, it sounds like a cliche, but you know, you have every game and enjoy every one. But it really is the case. I enjoy every game I play, because I never know when it might be the last one, or you know, the last time I can be involved. But I've got a 2-year playing contract at Dover, player coach contract, so at least this season and next season I'll be involved in a playing capacity in some respect. So, but you know, if I can keep myself fit and healthy and mentally, you know, right and able to play the games, I'll keep playing as long as he keeps putting my name and number out there.
Brilliant. Lee, thanks very much for coming in. We've enjoyed your enthusiasm for the game. It's evident that, you know, we've enjoyed it for the last hour, that how much you love football, and wish you the best of luck for the
pleasure.
Rest of the season.
Thanks so much for having me. Thank you. Cheers. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the KM Football Podcast. Click subscribe at Audio Boom and iTunes, and keep up to date with the latest stories at kentonline.co.uk.